The Cambridge Film Show on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 Radio across the city and South Cambridgeshire, and it's a warm welcome to a very special edition of the Cambridge Film Show. We hope you are enjoying the festive season, and we are delighted to share a bonus Christmas treat with our end of year show, presenting our top 12 films of 2021. Our reviewers, staff from the Cambridge Picture House and friends of the show have been sharing their favourite films of the year, and we have tossed up the results to reveal what Cambridge thinks is number one. The gang is all here to help me today and reveal our favourites. I'm joined by Emma, Vicky, Stuart, Lorcan, Ash, Henry and Mark, and we are ready to go. Quick shout out to some of our films that just missed out on featuring in our list, including the latest Marvel epic Spider-Man No Way Home, video game adventure Free Guy, and surprisingly, for some, Oscar Best Picture winner Nomadland. But now it's turkey done, tinsel up, time to start our countdown. At number 12, it's Lee Isaac Chung's Minari, the heartwarming and heartbreaking Oscar-nominated film about a Korean-American family who moved to Arkansas to live the American dream in the Ozarks. Minari was released at the beginning of 2021, but it is still in the hearts and minds of many of our reviewers, including our very own Emma Marchant. Emma, tell us what you loved about Minari.
I think it was a beautiful, beautiful film. It's got Steven Yeun stars as, it's semi-autobiographical, I believe, because the director, Lee Isaac Chung, was a Korean immigrant who moved to Arkansas in the 1980s. But it's just the most beautiful period film with wonderful performances and a heart like no other. Yoo Jung-yoon won Best Supporting Actress for her role as the matriarch of the grandmother who comes over and is trying desperately to keep the children in touch with their Korean heritage, but also as they're trying to build a life in rural Arkansas. And it got a bit, I think probably it came out similar time to Nomadland. There's a similar sort of vistas, and also from the eyes of, you know, made through the eyes of an immigrant, tells America through that. But this was just a perfect, perfect piece. It was just delightful.
Lorcan, I think you featured this in your top 12, didn't you? Could you tell us a little bit more about why you really loved this film?
Well, 2021 seems to be the year of the plotless meditative dramas. So it was very refreshing to see kind of more of an art house drama, character drama, that's very much driven forward, not just by the performances, but by the emotion and just the determination of each character kind of competing with each other. A24, the distributor, seems to have a really good eye for picking not just quality, interesting genre-bending films, but films that really have something to connect with audiences on a more universal level. And that's certainly what Minari was for me.
And Henry, as a story about, I mean, we've talked about it, it's fairly heartbreaking, it's a very moving film, but as a family drama, you know, you've got this central family who are really trying their hardest to make things work, and they come against all sorts of pitfalls. How do you think that relates to audiences?
I think on the surface, Minari seems like a very specific story about Korean immigrants moving to a very specific part of America. But as someone who is neither an immigrant nor an American, it still hits home and is about attempting to navigate the myths that we're kind of sold culturally about the countries in which we live. The UK is very different to America, but it still has this aspect of being sold things that we have to believe in with all of our hearts, or risk kind of losing everything. And that's what Minari is about. It's about kind of believing against all odds in the power of goodness, even as this new land tries to shut you down through that.
So deserving of its Oscar praise, I'm taking it from our group here.
Without a doubt. It's also a beautiful story of a marriage as well, I think. And a fact, there's many, many different layers in this, and all of them are beautifully done.
Thank you very much, team. So that is starting off our top 12. It is Minari. At number 11, it's an entry for DC with 2021's The Suicide Squad, directed by James Gunn. This anarchic tale of supervillains, Harley Quinn, Bloodsport and all, was a welcome rebound for our anti-heroes. So, Stuart, I'm going to come to you first on this one. I remember the 2016 Suicide Squad film with Jared Leto, etc., didn't really appeal to many people. Tell us what's different about this one.
So the original The Suicide Squad, I believe, was the original one. This one, I think, is called Suicide Squad. No, wrong way around. Mark's shaking his head. The other way around. It's already confusing. You can see the point. They rebooted the film series, and the previous one was it just sort of lacked any heart. It was clearly just cashing in on the characters to make some money. This one, however, it's got a lot more humor and it's got a lot more heart to it, and it's a lot more cheesy, and I think it borrows a lot more from sort of the cheesier side of DC Comics, which I think a lot of modern adaptations of the DC characters has missed. They've all gone for the super gritty, super sort of hardcore sort of take on the characters, and I think this one, having sort of done away with that a bit, it benefits greatly for it.
And Henry, as a superhero film, this one, you know, a lot of the DC films, they are quite violent. We've also mentioned that it's anarchic. Does that still appeal as part of its genre to people?
Well, I was worried about that going in. Over the last few years, the Deadpool films have brought the kind of irreverent, violent and, you know, immature but still appealing to adults kind of action comedy into the superhero genre. And so the worry was that that had gone stale. But I think The Suicide Squad, well, it doesn't revolutionize that kind of genre. It plays in that field very well and has a lot of fun in doing what it does. It's also very kind of thematically well-wound. I think the character of Polka Dot Man is a really great example in that he is on the surface a complete joke of a character. And yet the film lends him a real gravitas and allows him to have genuine emotional pathos by the end, despite being a man whose only power is to shoot polka dots out of his arms.
Emma, I'll come to you just around some of the performances. Perhaps we see Margot Robbie again, we've got Idris Elba and many, many others. How do they fare in this kind of ensemble piece?
Yeah, well, you obviously have this excellent opening start where there are a lot of big names that don't necessarily last so long in this film. So there are there's a lot of star power in this. But if James Gunn can do something, because let's not forget, of course, this was made in between James Gunn being sort of quasi sacked by Disney Marvel, having, you know, made Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2, which are in many people's top 10 Marvel films. He then went ahead and went to the dark side and perhaps was given a little bit more of a opportunity to go a bit harder than he would do with your standard Marvel. And I think that if anyone can manage a cast of big names and bring out fun and also, as Henry said, moving performances out of them, it's James Gunn. For me, the standouts, I think Margot Robbie, after the emancipation of Harley Quinn, I enjoyed her character much more in this one. She was a standout. John Cena's a standout. And Idris Elba is always worth the price of admission, would we not say? It's a whole heap of fun. I didn't see the original, but I really, really enjoyed this.
Looking at, I don't know if you've seen the original, but do you agree with Emma there that that's a really good fun watch?
Yes, absolutely. I think normally I wouldn't put kind of blockbuster fare on my top 10 list, especially comic book movies, because they tend to feel like they're directed by a committee and a team of thousands of kind of disparate animators. But there's absolutely no way you can't say that this is a James Gunn film. I've been a fan of James Gunn for a while. He kind of lost interest in him as a filmmaker when he went to Disney, because I would say he neutered himself a little bit. So for him to come over to Warner Brothers and DC and make this property that is unashamedly James Gunn, he's not afraid to have characters wallow in how despicable they are, yet he constantly finds ways of bringing pathos to them. The structure of the film is fantastic and constantly engaging. There's no characters I didn't like. And like Henry says, thematically, it's very satisfying.
Thank you. That's a great way to wrap that one up. It's just missed out on our top 10, but it's still very popular with our team. That is The Suicide Squad at number 11. Okay, we are going into our top 10 films of 2021, and sneaking its way at number 10, its recent Japanese release, Drive My Car, Ryosuke Hamaguchi's haunting road film about a renowned stage actor who must confront painful truths from his past after the disappearance of his wife. The film won 3 awards at Cannes 2021, including Best Screenplay. We reviewed this fairly recently, a couple of weeks ago, and Vicky did a sterling job of telling us why this film deserves all the attention that it's getting. So, Vicky, I'm just going to very quickly come to you again. Tell us why you love this film.
I think, personally, this is my favourite Murakami adaptation that's been on the screen. I love most of his work that gets translated, but this definitely is the showstopper for me. It is so worth the 3-hour long runtime. It is beautiful, slow, mysterious. I'm so absorbed in all of the characters and all of the mysteries and the tension between all the characters. This definitely has become just an all-time favorite in my eyes.
And Henry, I think you've seen this one too. Can you tell our listeners what's to love about it?
Well, I think on the surface there is a worry with Drive My Car that it is a 3-hour film, and it is very slow, some might say, but it's deliberately paced. It does take its time with the storytelling, and that is the joy in it. Characters begin with very glacial relationships in which they say very little to each other and reveal very little with their face. But over that 3-hour runtime, the ice slowly melts and they begin to show different sides to themselves or let loose a secret that they perhaps weren't willing to before. Nothing really happens. It's a series of scenes in which people drive or act or just talk. Those are the three things. And yet every single scene is more compelling than the last.
How relatable do we think the characters are? I mean, it's quite, there are several moving moments, and the cast is rightly, I'm assuming, been picked up on their performances. Could we just go into that a little bit, Vicky?
Yeah, of course. So I don't actually think the characters are relatable in many ways. They can be relatable in their sadness, but a lot of their motives and the way they're portrayed on screen is deliberately, I think, in an unrelatable way, because the murderers, they have these weird... If they were just talked or had more communication, then it'd be easier to understand them. But that's what keeps the mystery throughout all of it. And in the Uncle Vanya arc of the story, deliberately, they've put a lot of different languages in there. And because of all these language barriers, they have to link through their different emotions. And I think only their emotions are the most relatable part of them.
Thank you very much. So that is our number 10 film of 2021. It is Drive My Car. Next up, we go to number 9, which is No Time to Die, the 25th film in the famous Bond franchise that sees Daniel Craig return for his final appearance as the distinguished James Bond. Directed by Kerry Joji Fukunaga, No Time to Die features Bond living the peaceful life of retirement until a scientist has been kidnapped and all sorts of chaos ensues. Mark, there was a lot of talk about this film because it is Daniel Craig's final soiree as James Bond. Is there much else to talk about?
There is, but I think we have to, first of all, talk about Daniel Craig. I think when you think back 15 years, how much negativity there was around him even taking on the role, he has absolutely made this role his own over the course of 5 films, and he's at his best in No Time to Die. It's going to be an incredibly hard act to follow for whoever takes on the James Bond mantle next. And really, so many of the best moments of this film are centered around Daniel Craig. There's a lot to like as well, particularly the action scenes in the first half. It does try to tie together as best it can some of the incredible loose threads of the previous films, but ultimately the reason why this film has been so successful, in my view, you can sum up in 2 words: they are Daniel and Craig.
Emma, where do you think this fits amongst other Bond films? Is it one of the better ones?
Yes, it was for me. I mean, obviously this came with a slightly troubled background. I would say originally it was meant to be Danny Boyle, wasn't it? And then he did, you know, he dropped out because I think he wanted to make one a more socialist Bond. Kerry Joji Fukunaga makes such a good fist of this. I would say as well, though, maybe, Mark, that maybe there are 3 words as to why this film is so good, and that could be Phoebe Waller-Bridge, could it not, with her much talked about script brush up, if you like, afterwards. And I must admit, they gave Daniel Craig so much better lines than they've ever. He was actually allowed to be amusing and to hark back a little bit more to the kind of Roger Moore style James Bond, maybe, but in a more masculine and realistic way. I think it was long, but you know, at the end of the day, it deserves its place in our top 10. It deserves its place in any top 10 because this did come out all guns blazing, get people back into cinemas. People loved it. You know, it is a multi-generational thing. I've now watched it with my 11-year-old son and my 81-year-old father, and we all found stuff to enjoy in it. And it's a really well-made action movie. And Mark is right. I mean, Daniel Craig is spectacular.
And we've talked a lot about Daniel Craig, but it might be worth giving a shout out to some of the other members of the cast, thinking about Rami Malek as the villain. We've got Lashana Lynch, Ana de Armas, several, you know, it's a big cast, including some regular favourites like Ben Whishaw, for example. Lorcan, I'll come to you. Are there any standouts amongst that cast, or is this purely Daniel Craig?
No, without a doubt, Ana de Armas deserves a huge credit. Even though she's only in the film for about 10 minutes, she is hands down the standout. Not to take anything away from anyone else, but that's just such a fun insert, and she completely steals the show, and she's one of the more memorable parts of the film. I agree with them in that I think they gave Daniel Craig a lot more to work with in this Bond. I think I've been waiting a while for James Bond to become fun again. But I think the key to why No Time to Die works is Cary Fukunaga's filmmaking. Ever since True Detective, the first season, he's been on a lot of people's radar. And there's strong purpose behind his directing. He never seems to make a bad decision. Every decision he makes is a very deliberate one. And his kind of eye and his kind of fluid motion and everything's there for a purpose is really what makes No Time to Die stand out. I think for me, it's definitely the best Bond we've had in maybe 25 years.
Wow, that's some praise there. We've talked a little bit about this is Daniel Craig's last go as Bond. I'm just going to cheekily ask if anybody has any wishes or desires for what's next to come from the Bond franchise.
I think the speculation will always continue about who's going to be the next Bond. I'm going to put my vote in now for Reggie Jean Page, who people who've seen Bridgerton will know very well. I think some of the other names discussed are now probably a little too old to have a long run as Bond. You could have maybe a one-off Idris Elba, but I don't think there's a franchise in him, sadly. But I do trust the producers because they got it so right with Daniel Craig that whoever is picked next is going to be the right choice.
I would say, and it won't be anyone that we've heard of, I don't think. Anyone whose name ever comes up as Bond never seems to end up being Bond. It'll be someone that none of us have heard of.
Shout out to Jamie Dornan.
Okay, so we may, you never know, we may see another Bond film coming up in our top 12 films of the year in the future, but that was No Time to Die, and it is our number 9 film. Moving on, and it's time for our number 8 film, which is Another Round, the Danish tragicomedy directed by Thomas Vinterberg and starring Mads Mikkelsen, about 4 teachers who consume alcohol on a daily basis to see how it affects their social and professional lives. Victoria, I think this one was one of your top films of the year. Tell us a little bit more about why you like it so much.
This is a great performance by Mads Mikkelsen. It's the most, I haven't seen him in such a vulnerable way in quite some time. He usually plays the villain. He usually has a strong kind of off-putting manner in a lot of his stuff, but I really felt victim to his kind of sensitive, you know, his sensitive side in this, and just him with such a great friendship group where they all show their vulnerabilities on screen. This is definitely just one of those films that I watched, loved, enjoyed every minute of it. And definitely his performance at the end brought such a great ending to like what might be like, it's not a perfect film, but I've had the best experience watching this year on screen.
Thank you. Lorcan, I think you've also seen this film. I seem to remember actually at the beginning of the year, I hadn't heard of it, and then it started appearing a lot in awards circuits and getting quite a bit of attention. What can our listeners expect from watching this film?
A slightly unusual trip into an experiment between 4 teachers who, and it's an experiment, they're talking about like remaking this film in other countries, including America, which I'd actually be quite interested in because each country has its own kind of specific drinking culture and you can adapt this premise around each country individually and explore various different avenues. So I think for me, the idea of the film is the strongest element. And then the performances really carry you. You really feel for all these characters and you're genuinely curious to see where it goes. And it goes in unexpected directions throughout. But I think audiences can expect a fun, relatable time.
And Emma, I'll come to you. I mean, there's something about this film around sort of the midlife crisis. I'm just wondering how this is explored and your takes on the film.
Well, I guess that being quite close to Mads Mikkelsen's age myself and also living through this pandemic where, let's face it, alcohol has been a crutch for many of us, perhaps more than it should have been. I think this came out at a really, interesting time, and it spoke to me from that point of view, because also he is, you know, these guys are all, some of them are unhappy in their marriages, some of them are happier in their marriages. It also, let's not forget, comes with this, this was not the film that Thomas Vinterberg set out to make. He started to make it, and right near the beginning of filming, his daughter was killed tragically in a drunk driving accident. And so it took on a very different feel from that, and the director has come forward and said that. So I think it adds then that emotional weight. But as both Lorcan and Vicky said, it is anchored by this incredible performance by Mads Mikkelsen, and the dance scene at the end, if you don't find some sense of cathartic joy in that as he leaps around the Copenhagen port, then you are dead inside, is what I would say. It's got things to say. I really like that fact that Lorcan said that maybe they'll make it in different countries, because, like you say, every country feels differently about its alcoholism or lack thereof. And this is a very this is a very Danish film, but it's just it was a gem this year, and I would have loved to have seen Mads Mikkelsen get all the awards for it.
Thank you very much, everyone. That is our number 8 film, which is Another Round. We are getting through our top 12 films of the year, and at number 7 we have Promising Young Woman, which is written and directed by Emerald Fennell and stars Carey Mulligan as a woman who is overcoming a tragic event from her past by seeking out vengeance and living a secret double life at night. Ashley, I will come to you on this one. The film Promising Young Woman, it has some quite tricky subject matter at its centre. How do you think the film handles that?
I loved and kind of also hated how controversial it is in 2021 to tell our story on screen. So by our story, I mean every woman. So every single woman will have had some experience of having been in some situation which could have ended in them being harmed or even their death. But I liked how this film was made for those who need to see it. So the subject matter, I think, is handled very lightly throughout. And there's just a few hard-hitting scenes that drive it home. But the best bit and the thing that everyone should learn their lesson from the most is in the quote, the casting of kind of the quote-unquote nice guy roles. So it was inspired that you get to see the men who played McLovin in Superbad, Seth in The O.C., Schmidt in New Girl do unspeakable things to women. And I think that's what drove the message home in this masterpiece.
Strong words there for a masterpiece from Ashley Henry. Do you think this is a masterpiece?
I think it is. And I agree with Ash. It is so brilliant because it is such a tricky film. I don't have quite the same relationship to the subject matter, but it still is completely gripping. You know, it came out around a similar time in the UK. We had the Sarah Everard case, and it added a really tragic extra layer to it. But yeah, I think Promising Young Woman is so smart about how it deals with its subject matter. It feels like it could, like it's building towards this moment of grand exploitation, madness. And then it very cleverly subverts that and kind of says, no, that's not what we're doing here as well. And I think the ending as well has also been very controversial, but it's again brilliant because of how it refuses to let you feel comfortable in your final assumptions and kind of ends on this last little wink towards the audience saying, you gotta think again.
Emma, we've talked a little bit about the subject matter, so feel free to come in on that. But also I'd like to ask about Carey Mulligan as this amazing central performance, as this woman who is battling against things that have happened in her past, not just to her, but to other people, and is trying to somehow fix those wrongs. How does she do in that role?
I am so pleased you asked me that, because I The Dig almost made my top 12 as well this year, which was the Sutton Hoo docudrama with her and Ralph Fiennes. And to think that Carey Mulligan went from that role to this role, and they came out within like weeks of each other, really, I think she's becoming one of our most promising young actresses. No, one of us, she really is one of our most exciting exports. And I did not expect this, you know, this performance is, again, it's a tour de force from her. She's ably backed up by Bo Burnham, who then produced one of the best things that anyone ever saw in the pandemic with his Inside comedy special. But Bo Burnham as her kind of, is he nice, is he not, boyfriend, it was really good. Also, you've got Jennifer Coolidge and Clancy Brown as her parents. I loved everything. I loved the darkness that was hidden in this pastel coloured scenario with these weird, you know, and it's a very conscious set design. But I agree with both Ash and Henry. It took a difficult subject matter. It made it semi-palatable, but it also left you thinking for days. It's a really exciting debut from Emerald Fennell and another great performance from Carey Mulligan.
You are listening to Cambridge 105 and our festive feature from the Cambridge Film Show. We are halfway through counting down our top 12 films of 2021, and we're about to talk about number six. Our number six film is Sound of Metal, Darius Marder's powerful film about a drummer played by Riz Ahmed who loses his hearing and has to come to terms with some dramatic changes. So, Henry, I'm going to come to you on this one. For some of our friends of the show, Sound of Metal is their number one or number two film. It's done very well with our team. Can you tell us what there is to like about it?
Well, I think the initial premise of Sound of Metal is one that is engaging. It's about someone losing their hearing in a way that's very, very sudden. It's no gradualness to it at all. And it sounds like the setup for a horror film. And for the first half hour or so, that is what the film is doing. But I think the thing that is brilliant about it is that, especially as it gets into the second half, it becomes a film of deep, deep empathy with a community most people aren't familiar with, which is the deaf community. It's so empathetic towards this world in which so many people are so unfamiliar. And I found myself constantly surprised and kind of heartbroken by what the film was talking about. I also think chief among the things to love here is Riz Ahmed, who is just incredible yet again here. He really seems to be putting no foot wrong since, you know, the one foot wrong in Venom. He is going from strength to strength at the moment, I think. If you need only one reason to watch the film, Ahmed is the one.
Thank you. Mark, the director, Darius Marder, has talked a lot about how it took him a long time to find the right people to play some of these characters in the film. Obviously, we've heard about how he's done sterling work with Riz Ahmed. Can you go into a little bit more detail about that and maybe some of the other cast members that might have impressed you?
I think I would say that it's easier to overlook Olivia Cooke's performance as well as the girlfriend, which is also fabulous. And, you know, I think it is a remarkable year that we've had when you consider how we've embraced the deaf community through things like Strictly Come Dancing, but also through this incredible film. I can't remember a film being so good at giving me empathy for the particular situation a character finds themselves in when I have no experience of that situation personally. You know, Riz Ahmed has to take a lot of the credit for actually making that work so effectively in the film. It's just a remarkable piece of work.
Ashley, the film, we've talked about it, it's remarkable. It's got these standout performances, and we've talked a lot about the subject matter. In his story, Riz Ahmed, he faces a lot of battles. There's a lot of uncertainty about what he's going to do. How does that work in terms of feeling empathy for his character and some of the others that we come across?
So, not surprisingly, this film won an Oscar for Best Sound, and the sound editing was my favourite thing. So I felt pulled in to Riz Ahmed's world when I needed to be, and also kind of excluded from the outside world when appropriate, and those things happen at different times. Riz's face as well, so expressive, and the director Darius Marder, who did The Place Beyond the Pines, which is also fantastic, got such a vulnerably intense performance out of him. And kind of harking back to what Henry and Mark were saying, the final message of the film about the acceptance of disability and the beauty to be found in life as a deaf person wasn't at all saccharine, and left the film on a brilliantly, quietly poignant note. I loved the ending. It was perfect.
perfect ending, and that is our number six film, which is Sound of Metal. Coming in to our top five now, and we are going to be talking about The Green Knight, which has done very well with some of our reviewers on the show, starring Dev Patel in the lead role of Sir Gawain. And I know we've talked about how to pronounce this, and I've probably done it wrong again. Confident nephew to King Arthur, David Lowry's The Green Knight is based on famous Arthurian legend, but sees a different take. Lorcan, you are one of several of our team who really loved this film. What have you got to shout about?
There seems to be a handful of filmmakers now who are really pushing the boundaries of genre, and they all seem to gravitate towards A24. David Lowry made this film. He made A Ghost Story, which I was a huge, huge fan of. And then you got people like David Robert Mitchell, Ari Aster, Robert Eggers, all seem to slide into a genre, a couple of genres, and really try to push what we know about them. And then that's kind of how you get trends started. So all that kind of stuff is really exciting. And Green Knight is a horror, fantasy, supernatural character drama that's completely satisfying. I was never quite sure where I was in the story, but I was completely enthralled. The performances are pitch perfect. There's a hearty mix of practical effects when needed and a kind of CGI when it's more necessary. I can't recommend it enough. I can't recommend watching it on the big screen enough as well.
Vicky, this is, for some, they might think this is sort of your typical Camelot adventure, but The Green Knight actually offers quite a lot different to this. But it's a film that does take its time and is open to interpretation. Does that work to its credit?
I definitely think so. I think the main thing I had to say about this is Camelot, but fantasy done well. I think like the last time we may visit Camelot in film would have been maybe Guy Ritchie's King Arthur a few years ago. But this is nothing of that storyline or of that pacing. It is, like you said, it's slow, but because of that, we get so much lore to it. There's all this like different parts that cinematography wise that you need to experience throughout this film. And definitely it's really sad that it couldn't have been experienced on the big screen, definitely because it went on demand so fast. But there's just certain, like Lorcan said, special effects that you just need to absorb, and seeing that with its pacing really helps. There's definitely storylines in this which are a bit maybe controversial. I wouldn't say it's family friendly. I think this is more mature in its viewing. I just, because of all of this, it's been taken a different way. I think I loved it more, and Dev Patel portrays Sir Gawain perfectly.
Mark, The Green Knight is an adaptation of the 14th century poem Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. It's a very artistic film. What makes this film a bit more substance over style?
I think it's probably the commitment of everyone involved to actually telling something that's fresh and different, even though it is a 14th century story adaptation. It feels both of its time and also remarkably contemporary. It constantly surprised me in the decisions and the directions it was taking in a very good way. I think the performances across the board are great. Dev Patel, fantastic in the lead role. And I'm just so impressed with the body of work that David Lowry is putting together. Lorcan mentioned A Ghost Story, which I loved as well. Either side of that, we had Pete's Dragon and The Old Man and the Gun, Robert Redford's swan song. And David Lowry has developed this knack for taking things that you might expect and actually coming up with something really genuinely different with them. You know, he's taking these tropes and he's making fresh, exciting cinema. And I think this is his greatest achievement today.
Thank you very much, Mark, Lorcan and Vicky, on that one. So we've just discussed The Green Knight and it has come in at number five. We are on to number four in our top 12 films of 2021, and it is one of many Marvel delights to entertain us this year. It's Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. Directed by Destin Daniel Cretton and starring Simu Liu, Awkwafina and Minghe Zhang, as well as many others, Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. It's done really, really well with many of our team and many of our friends of the show. I'm going to come to Stuart here. I always do, because he is the big Marvel fan of the group. Stuart, tell us what you make of Shang-Chi.
So, Shang-Chi, I thought this was a very interesting choice of character to introduce into the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Until now, the sort of the martial arts characters have been largely stuck in their other channels. So if we had the Netflix, we had Iron Fist and we've had Daredevil, but we haven't had a proper martial artist on the big screen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe yet. And they've gone for another unusual character who isn't necessarily a household name, kind of like an echo back to 2008's Iron Man, when no one was entirely sure. Not everyone knew who Iron Man was. And very, very quickly, Shang-Chi, now everyone knows who he is. It did very well in the box office. It certainly sort of caught the imagination of the fan base. And it's a very pretty film to watch. It's got a lot of, once they start getting into some of the sort of the inspiration from Chinese mythology, there's some very, very interesting imagery there. And whilst it is a lot, it's quite CGI heavy in that regard, at least the CGI is interesting. It is unique, and it certainly lends itself to the film rather than just being CGI for the sake of CGI.
Mark, how does this film do in introducing a very, you know, a new character? We've obviously finished recently with Endgame, the last phase. We're now into a new phase. We're getting lots of new Marvel characters and heroes introduced. Let's talk a little bit about Shang-Chi and a little bit about Simu Liu in that role.
I think there is a real risk that as we get deeper and deeper into the Marvel Universe, we just get origin story after origin story, and that they struggle with ways to tell these stories in fresh and exciting ways. What most excited me about this was actually those early scenes with Simu Liu and Awkwafina, where we actually get to see them in a family setting, in a domestic setting. And those feel like some of the most genuine scenes we've ever seen in the Marvel Universe. I actually felt as if we were seeing characters who came from a world that we could live in, which so often is not the case. As much as I love the Marvel movies, they often feel in their own fantasy world. But actually, I think a lot of the success of Shang-Chi is down to the fact of feeling that you could really be in the world of these characters, and then they are taken into a different world, which is so much fun to explore.
Emma, we've talked a little bit about Simu Liu and Awkwafina, but this is a really big cast. And I think one of the things that really struck me when I was watching this film, as well as being a brilliant action film, there's also a lot about the sort of family drama at the centre of it. And you've got people like Tony Leung, who's in it and does a fantastic performance as the father. How does that work? And it, you know, what makes it so special in this film?
You took my point away from me there, Yossi. I was going to say exactly the same thing. I was going to say what I loved about this was the casting of Michelle Yeoh and Tony Leung as, you know, stalwarts and absolute, the, you know, grandmaster and grandmistress of Chinese cinema, to bring them into this new Marvel film alongside Simu Liu, who I believe has done some TV work, hasn't he, on Fresh Off the, Kim's Convenience Store, isn't it? But was a stuntman as well, but it's one of the freshest and most charismatic actors I've seen come across my screen in a long time. But to have the combination of these heavyweights, also let's not undermine, of course, Sir Ben Kingsley, because I think it is your contracted to call him Sir Ben, I think, at all times. Sir Ben Kingsley coming back as Trevor Slattery from Iron Man 3, and they address that whole difficulty of the Mandarin question and how maybe that was a little whitewashed before, and it's brilliant. It was such a fun watch and came at such a good time, I think, for us all, after obviously a year and a half of pandemic and no cinemas. It was a big film for Marvel, and they really hit it right. And Stuart was completely right as well. The CGI is heavy, but it's gorgeous. I took my kids to go to see it. I've said this before, I think, on the show many times. I've kind of grown up with Marvel. In fact, Iron Man came out in 2008, which is a year after my twins were born. So just about every, it's a big deal in our house to go and see them. And I love that about it. And this went straight into Mars's top five films. As soon as we got out of there, he was like, that was boss. And I'm really excited to see where this character goes. And I knew nothing about it. So, you know, yeah, Shang-Chi, all about that.
Thank you. And final word from Vicky.
I went to go and watch this with a lot of my Asian friends, and in general, I haven't been this excited about a Marvel film maybe since Black Panther, and they've basically taken Black Panther and copyrighted it over to Shang-Chi, and that it's super inclusive. It has, you know, all these kind of actors that have paved the way for a lot of films, especially Tony Leung and Wong Kar-wai, but they also included 88 Rising on the soundtrack, which is a completely Asian-based music group and producers, and just they made it so fun. The relatableness to so many things in this, just my love for it is so deep now. And I definitely feel like when I came away from the screen, I'm like, this will be like, this is the Marvel film for me, kind of. And I think a lot of people will feel the same way about that.
Thank you very much. That is our number four film. It is Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. We have reached our top three films of 2021 on the Cambridge Film Show, and it's all getting very exciting because we are now at the time of our top three. And at number three, it is Celine Chama's Petite Maman, which has been delighting people at many a film festival. The film sees Josephine Sans star as Nelly, who has just lost her grandmother and is helping her parents clean out her mother's childhood home. One day, she meets a girl her same age building a treehouse, and a friendship follows. Henry, I'm going to come to you on this one. Can you tell us what there is to love about it?
Well, for a start, it's 72 minutes, which I think it is by far the shortest film on this list. And in a year where we've had very, very long films, that in itself can be a bit of an oasis. But what's incredible is that in that very short runtime, so much is packed in. It's this story about the bonds between parents and children. And while the film is explicitly about mothers and their daughters, it has this beautiful heart and this childlike wonderment, this way of looking at the world in which everything is still fluid. There aren't yet those restrictions on the world that teenagedom and your adulthood put on it. There's just a simple joy to getting to exist in this film for the short time in which you're with it. It is one of the most beautiful cinematic experiences I've had this year. It's an absolute pleasure.
Mark, Celine Chama, the director, is doing wonders. She's got a lot of great attention for some of her previous films. I'm thinking of Girlhood and A Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And, you know, what she seems to be really good at is thinking about sort of relationships, female relationships, either between friends, or we've talked about parents here, or in Portrait of a Lady on Fire, a romantic relationship. What is it in Petite Maman that really sells this?
I think it's difficult to know quite where to start because there's so many things that make this such an incredible film. Undoubtedly, Celine Chama's writing and direction is one of them. You mentioned some of her previous films. I think the first of her films was Tomboy, almost 10, 11 years ago. I am a massive fan of Portrait of a Lady on Fire as well. I think in terms of directors, she is up there for me with anyone working at the moment. But I think just simply how much craft, how much emotion, how much empathy is crammed into such short running time. I laughed. I genuinely did have a tear in my eye, it just, when we are burdened with so many 2.5 hour plus films in cinemas at the moment, and indeed many of the films on our list this year, which have been fantastic films, but it really does show that a film should be no longer than it needs to be, and that the amount of perfection that is encompassed here in an hour and 10 minutes is just a breathtaking and a joy to watch.
A question for one or both of you, you can both come in on this one. I mentioned there in a little very short synopsis of the film that there's an element of grief and melancholy in this film. I'm just interested to know, as an experience, you know, is this a really emotional film? What can we expect to feel as we watch it?
It is very emotional, but it's never harrowing or pushes you too far. It's rated U. I believe the BBFC rating for it said it contained very mild reference to bereavement, which in its own way is a very cute kind of age rating thing. It is going to kind of push you and move you. You know, there's sadness as you may be thinking about your own relatives you've lost, but there's joy as well, and you leave. It's not a melancholy film at all, like say Portrait of a Lady on Fire was. It's a film that even its sadder notes leave you feeling that much happier afterwards. You will walk out just a lighter human being, feeling grateful for the time you spent with the film.
I will just follow up on that by saying I think what Celine Chama has tapped into here is the innocence and the sometimes unfiltered nature of childhood, that to really examine issues as complex as bereavement through that prism is a really tricky thing. She's got two such fantastic actresses. It's been an incredible year for young performances. But, you know, to find that way into grappling with things that we all at some point in life ultimately have to grapple with, but to really find an interesting take on it, I'm going to be going out to buy my Celine Sciamma t-shirt very soon.
Thank you. You've sold it to me. I'm really looking forward to seeing it in the future. Thank you very much, Henry and Mark. That was our number three film, which is Petite Maman. Can you believe it? We are at our top two films of 2021 and just missing out on the top spot. It's The French Dispatch, Wes Anderson's loving ode to journalism with a very multi-talented cast, including Tilda Swinton, Benicio del Toro, Adrian Brody, and many others. I am very aware that there are several fans of the film in our team today. Lorcan, why'd you love it?
Oh, I'm so glad you came to me first. A lot of people seem to say that this film was too much Wes Anderson, which thoroughly confuses me because, I really hate a film that's too funny, visually witty, has immaculate performances, incredible set design, incredible color palettes, impeccable editing. For me, it's quite episodic, but the thing that really ties it all together is that all the stories, it's split up into five or six stories, but each story is very much told from the perspective of the writer that's been established earlier in the film, and every writer is effectively just a lonely person who's seeking acceptance or is seeking to fill some void in their life through the material they write about. And that is infused in every single story that's told. And then it's infused on top of the meta narrative or the framing narrative of the publisher of the magazine itself. And I can't help to feel that there's something going on with Wes Anderson himself, whereas like he seems to have these recurring themes of characters whose only solace is in their loneliness. There's not an aspect of the film that I didn't honestly think was kind of flawless and impeccably pulled off.
Vicky, he's a very visual director, is Anderson, and Lorcan's mentioned for some people, they say that this is too Wes Anderson. I know you disagree. What is it about this that we shouldn't just be concentrating on the fact that it's very stylistic?
I think what I say for any Wes Anderson fan is that everything you love about him is in this film. We've said on the radio previously that if you are starting out with Wes Anderson, this shouldn't be your first film to watch because it'd be too much. But I just completely refuse. I think if you start with his favorite actors, for one, Wes Anderson's acting troupe, as you call them, you know, it features, you know, Tilda is a strong one. You've got Jason Schwartzman, Bill Murray. They're just perfect performances. They embody their characters so well, even in these, like you mentioned, like lonely performances. And I just feel like in general, this film is everything I love on screen. It's got tiny miniatures for the cooking scenes. It's got these giant paintings. It's got incredible costumes. And I don't understand why how someone can be too stylized when it's a person that you love about it, I guess. Maybe you can disagree with me.
I don't think we have many people here who would disagree with you. Ashley, what do you think?
This film is too Wes Anderson, and I love it. So that opening scene with the waiter running up through all the buildings, down the stairs, like an advent calendar of cinematography for me. And funny enough, I think Lorcan's alluded to this. I liked the overall send-up of the art world, which I think is the wider message of this film. So Wes Anderson knows his stuff is heavy on the style end of substance and that he's often criticized for that. So I think here he's doffing his cap to those who love him for his style, and we are happy to read our own substance into his avant-garde characters and the weird worlds he creates. So it's too Wes and it's too perfect.
What if you don't like Wes Anderson?
Then watch a Marvel film and leave me alone.
Emma, what about people that might not be that into Wes Anderson? How can you sell this film to them?
I would say if you don't go and enjoy the Tilda Swinton section where she's wearing possibly the best orange dress I've ever seen on any cinema screen ever, apart from my own orange dress that I got bought for my birthday, then you are, again, you're dead inside. No, what I can say in this, Vicky was talking about the fact you've got Wes's usual coterie of actors, but you've got, it's like everyone, I don't know if people were just bored because it'd been the pandemic and no one had been able to make anything, but it's like you've got everyone in the entire Hollywood world seems to be in this film. From Benicio del Toro, who hasn't been in a Wes Anderson film, and it was such a joy to see him, to, I think, Saoirse Ronan pops up at some point in the world's most. Christoph Waltz, Oscar winner Christoph Waltz, gets like one line, but he was still prepared to turn up and go and do it because it's just this brilliantly crafted. It didn't come second for me, I won't lie, but I did. And it is super mannered. And I'd love to know what actual real life French people thought about it. But, you know, again, if you're not charmed by Owen Wilson riding a bicycle in the first 5 minutes of this film, then who even are you? Wes Anderson is, he's incredibly important to, you know, to cinema in general. I think everything he's done has been applauded by critics and by the people who love him. And this is just more of the same. And I'm fully here for it because no one else does it like him.
And I will say as well, I think a lot of the people saying it's a little too much. For me, that just gives the film a lot of rewatchability. It was like no one's going to sit through this film and catch every visual gag or every little clever line of dialogue, but that just makes it more fun to go back and watch it over and over again to catch every single little clue.
And to say very quickly as well, Léa Seydoux, I thought, was really underwritten in a James Bond film, and she in this gets a really fun part, so I really enjoyed seeing her.
I will just very quickly say, as one of those people who felt for me it was too much Wes Anderson, being a huge fan of his, of any of the films this year, whether I loved them or not, that I want to go back and revisit and try again, it's this one.
There you go, Mark.
There we go.
It's all round excitement.
Very good. So that is our number two film. It's just missed out on the top spot, but it is loved by many here. It's Wes Anderson's The French Dispatch. So we've made it. We are at our number one film for 2021, which is June. Denis Villeneuve's adaptation of Frank Herbert's science fiction novel with Timothy Chalamet and Rebecca Ferguson and Jason Momoa. And clearly it has wowed many of our team and our friends. So Mark, why is June our number one film?
I think for me, it is the first film I can remember seeing in a cinema for all the sci-fi epics I've seen over the years that genuinely made me feel, first of all, incredibly tiny. The sheer epic scale of this film actually made me feel less than my normal 6'2" height. I actually felt I was shrinking away from the screen. So epic was the scale that Denis Villeneuve has conjured up here. But also, if you think that the source material, Frank Herbert's original, you know, seminal novel, even someone as good as David Lynch couldn't get to grips with it. This is how tough the work is to try to adapt for the screen. And in my opinion, Denis Villeneuve has done an incredible job. And he's only adapted the first half of it so far, but I am so excited to see what he's got for part two.
Vicky, I think this was also in your top 12 films of the year. I mentioned briefly some of the cast members here and some of the performances that we see. There's quite a very talented ensemble cast here. Is there anyone of note?
I think we also mentioned this on air, but it was Rebecca Ferguson stole this show. I think obviously you've got Timothy, he's the leading man. This is probably the best role I've seen from him. I know from this year he's had a lot of roles, this is my favorite, but Rebecca Ferguson, the way that she is deceiving on screen and you can see her other intents, I was completely captivated in that performance. I'm going to mention him just because if I don't, someone else will, but Jason Momoa, like, he's just been Jason Momoa on screen. It's the same with the other, like, he's just so present. He's just playing himself. He's having all this fun and it's such a joy to watch. Maybe I could mention Oscar Isaac. He was silent, he was brooding, he just looked very good with that cinematography. But Jason Momoa, Josh Brolin and Rebecca Ferguson were the real, they really stole the show for me. I'm really sad to say Zendaya, I wish I could say that she brought too much to the film, but I think I'll wait for part two because she has about 5 minutes of screen time, which everyone's aware of. But yeah, I'm very excited to see what's to come of this and just how everyone adapts and changes. But I'm quite glad that they've broken it up, because I think there's a lot to this world building, and I'm excited for this to become maybe three films, but definitely two to focus on for the next coming years.
Henry, it's clearly resonated with quite a lot of our listeners, our friends of the show, some of our team here. But the film is 2 hours and 35 minutes long, and we've talked about how visual it is. How does the story keep people engaged?
I think the story is so in depth. That's how it works. You know, we've already spoken about how this is just the first part of one novel, and that previous adaptations have done their best but have ended up slightly messy. And yeah, I think the length helps. You know, I was talking earlier about the brilliance of Batim Amman being so short, and I think actually the brilliance of Dune is that it could be much longer. You're so content in this world and the kind of the political intrigue that's going on that you want to see more. And I think Villeneuve does a really good job at balancing the slower paced intrigue and the more cerebral bits with brilliant visual spectacle in a way that is sure to keep both cinephiles and general audiences on the edge of their seats for the entire lengthy runtime and likely well into part two.
Final word on just what's so great and what we can expect from maybe part two.
I think we all agreed that this isn't our top film of our list, but because it has been mentioned by so many of our friends of the show and just in general, I think this is a real film that stood out at the cinema this year. It definitely helped the box office. I just think it's one of the films that kind of pleased and excited everyone. I'm just glad that cinema's back, at least for this film, because it was definitely needed to be seen on the big screen.
I think our top 12 in general is a really good summation of why cinema is still so essential, why we need that experience of watching films together, experience them together, and watching films on the biggest screens we can find.
Well, that's a pretty great way to end it. Thank you very much, Mark. That was our number one film. It was June. You have listened to our top 12 films of 2021. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much to our team here today, who've done some amazing summaries and given their reviews of our films. Our next show is due to be on Saturday, the 8th of January. See you then.